This is a, yeah, that's right.
Work session.
Both of them, correct?
Nope, because we haven't finished the hearing on the transmission line.
So which one?
Just the wind farm, not this.
All right, good morning, everyone. It is 9:01 on Wednesday, August 28th, 2019. I'm Commissioner Brian Crassus, joined by Commissioner Julie Fedorchak and Commissioner Randy Christman. This is a work session on Russo Wind Partners wind project in Ward and McLean County, case number PU-19-28. I don't have any opening comments. Commissioner Christman?
Nor do I, thank you.
And before I turn it over to Commissioner Fedorchak, the portfolio holder, why don't we have staff and council please identify themselves for the record?
Thank you, Commissioner. Zach Pelham, Special Assistant Attorney General on behalf of the Commission.
Jerry Land with staff.
Adam Renfield with staff.
All right, thank you. Commissioner Fedorchak, it's all yours.
Good morning, everybody. So just to clarify, I know our notice said this was a work session on both the wind farm and the transmission line, but my understanding is we're not going to be acting on the transmission line, so I assume we won't be talking about that today. Is that your understanding, Zach?
I think that there's a couple of things that I asked for it to be added just because there's a couple areas on the periphery that I thought that
okay.
The commission should be aware of as far as updates that I've received from the company since that hearing was postponed.
Okay, sorry.
That's okay.
Maybe Ryan wants to correct the...
All right, and then we will add. It will also include a discussion on case number PU-19-29, and that is also Russo Wind Partners, the 230 kV transmission line in McHenry and Ward County.
All right. With that clarified, there were a number of late-filed exhibits and some information that came in as late as yesterday. So I think, Zach, if it's okay, we'll just have you walk through everything. Does that work for the purpose of the work session?
That was my plan, Commissioner.
Okay,
so
good.
We're on the same
page. We talked
page.
About things, but we didn't talk
yeah,
about that.
No. So on August 9th, the company provided a bevy of late filed exhibits as well as proposed findings of fact. We'll just go in order. Late file exhibit 49 is related to supplemental sound and shadow flicker modeling results. I think it's probably appropriate, though, to also maybe first talk about some changes in turbines. You may recall, you probably do recall at the hearing there was some questions as to what the Air Force and the company had some issues that needed to be worked out, and actually in late filed exhibit 51, and I'm already going out of order and I apologize, but that summarizes the discussions held between the company and Minot Air Force Base and the Air Force Department of Defense after the hearing. And in a nutshell, the company agreed to move turbine locations, well, to remove rather from the project, turbine T12, 13, 14, and 26 at the request of Air Force and replace them with alternates T48, 51, 53, and 54. There was also an issue with the aircraft detection lighting system. Quite a significant issue that the Department of Defense informed the company's consultant that, for all intents and purposes, that the ADLS system they had a large problem with. And I asked Ms. Smith, the attorney for the company, for further information after I received late filed exhibit 51. And as to what some of the issues were. Proximity to launch facilities was the primary concern. Some setbacks apparently that the military has on those facilities. Also,
Zach, yeah. As it relates to that, are you talking about the ALDS? This is what they said?
I'm talking about
the ALDS or for the removal of those turbines?
The ADLS.
Oh, ADLS.
Yeah.
Okay. So if the proximity to the facilities, the launch facilities is the issue, seems like that was addressed by removing those turbines.
Yeah, I don't have a good understanding as to specifics on that. I've received just a summary email from Ms. Smith on that, and that was, and I can certainly follow up.
Okay, so I just if that's one issue that I have, but I appreciate getting the list of what they feel the Air Force said were the issues. So proximity to launch facilities.
The other reason, the second reason is Minot Air Force noted tactical concerns regarding implementation of ADLS. It would allow lighting to come on when aircraft approach the project, and the system would effectively allow the, quote, bad guys in the vicinity of the military facilities to know that Air Force aircraft were approaching. Capital Airspace, which is a consultant of the company, reached out to the DOD clearinghouse to discuss partial implementation. There's not a specific response on that inquiry yet, but they have reached out. One of my questions to Ms. Smith was whether or not, you know, it would be possible for part of the project to be inclusive of ADLS or not. The early indication is that DOD would not, you know, be inclined to do that, but they are asking and inquiring. I don't have an answer on that. The company's position is essentially that they must defer to the FAA.
Right.
And, you know, in terms of where the commission is at, while there's a state law in place, there's federal law, the FAA, there's no doubt that the FAA has control over the airspace and regulations related to that. I have not researched this issue, but I can tell you that if push came to shove, there would be state-federal preemption issues on law on that. So I do think that FAA would have effectively the final say on this, which is not to say that we as a commission, if we wanted to approach DOD and see whether or not some of their concerns could be addressed or allayed, when DOD puts its recommendations to FAA, because FAA is, from what I'm told from the company's representative, is going to effectively go along with the recommendations of the Minot Air Force Base / DOD on this. So all that to say is, well, I should say this first. It's my impression and my belief that the company was completely unaware of this going into the hearing, and I think, to be fair to them, they did work with Minot Air Force Base prior to the hearing. They did send correspondence, and everyone here got a curveball in this proceeding, in my opinion, which isn't to say, obviously, now we've got to deal with it. We've got to address the issues here with the ADLS. So with that said, I think that there's still more information that we as staff need to work on with the company to get you before any final decisions can be made on this particular issue.
So I appreciate that, Zach, and to the company for getting that information and trying to work through this. From my perspective, I'll be curious what the company finds out about partial implementation and if they are provided any more information as to the specific concerns. My position is that we, you know, at some point, if the company is being told one thing, that we might need to just talk to the Air Force ourselves to make sure that we're all kind of understanding what the concerns are and how they can be or can't be addressed. I'm not saying that we want to create trouble, but I also know that there's a fair number of these facilities around, and they're in remote areas where, you know, those lights running 24/7 all the time might be an exaggerated response to what their need is. And so I think that we owe it to the folks to work a little more with the parties to really get to the bottom of what the issues are and how they can be addressed to potentially find a solution that is good for everybody.
I would just add to that, Commissioner and Commissioners, just so you know, there's two other wind farms in this area that already exist, and under our new lighting requirements under statute, there's a requirement that they, they were permitted after the statute, but they're still required under state law to have ADLS systems. Be interesting to know, maybe we should reach out to them to see whether or not they've had any discussions with the Air Force on this, because from what I understand, other launch facilities are in the same proximity to these two other already existing in-place wind farms, and it is an issue for the Commission because we need to know what the status of the implementation of ADLS is for those two additional wind farms.
Well, I'm just going to interject here at a lot of risk since it's an area I sure don't know much about, but with regard to the first of the objections that you mentioned, the proximity to launch facilities, I was trying to read into what the issues would be there, but if they're launching something from close by, then does it start too close and move too fast to ever, have anything to do with the lights and hit something? But more importantly, probably, as far as the lights being on in general, I've never understood how, like, stealth planes, what they do physically and operationally so that the enemy can't detect them, but do we have aircraft out there that are not going to set off these alerts and bring the lights on, possibly, and that might be a concern. If it is, they don't just fly around their facilities. If they're able to prevent using ALDS on these that are very proximate to their facilities, how big of a circle do they draw around their facilities? Are they going to not want us to use them anywhere in the state all of a sudden?
I think
we have a lot of unresolved questions here with the Air Force.
I think the primary, and I could be wrong, but reading the late file Exhibit 51 documents, it seems that the security response forces from the Air Force Base to these launch facilities, they utilize helicopters. And utilization of helicopters to go to the specific launch facilities is impeded by, one, the turbine locations, and two, if ADLS's technology is used when they're in the airspace, the lights are going to come on. So then that's the comment from the company's attorney indicating that the, quote, bad guys would be aware that there is an aircraft in the area.
Okay.
But I think, as I said, I think, as we dig into this, there's probably some more, not probably, there are some more questions that we need answers to.
And that's a good point. I would wonder if the Department of Defense would be equally concerned about partial implementation for exactly that same reason, that, well, an aircraft is not within X number of miles, but it's within this radius, which more specifically pinpoints its location.
And that very well may be the case. My thought in asking about partial implementation was this, well, okay, I understand this, and I never committed, obviously, anything. I'm just asking questions at this point. What about the possibility of partial implementation?
Sure.
And that's what they're asking. And I don't disagree with you, Commissioner Crashus. I think that is a possible response. Ultimately, though, what the FAA determines is going to, in my opinion, going to be effectively the final say, unless we were to challenge it. And if,
well, the state law even acknowledges that.
It does.
It has to be
approved
by the FAA.
It has to meet with the FAA requirements.
Yeah. So the other thing that, and I think this is why we need to get more information with the Air Force, so I want to talk procedure in a second, but the other lighting systems that are being developed, it would be good to know if those might have a different fate with this review, if it was the dimming versus the on-off stuff. So I think some conversations with the Air Force and DOD, however we can do that procedurally are kind of in order. I mean, we can wait and see what the company finds out from the questions that they've asked again. But then how would we go about procedurally doing this, Zach?
Well, I think, you know, we have contacts with Minot Air Force Base. I know in the past we've had not similar issues, but, you know, issues on setbacks and locations and follow-up with certain officials at the Air Force Base. And I think staff has had those conversations. I know that our rules related to setbacks on launch facilities for all of the facilities that are cited by the commission had their genesis in discussions specifically with the Air Force Base many years ago, and I know that Alana was involved with that specifically in those discussions. But there is the ability procedurally to do that. We as staff can inquire as well.
Can we invite them here for a work session? I mean, could it be something like that, or is it just staff calling and talking?
Yeah, I think looking at Pat Fawn, and Pat gives a nod, yeah, I think that is something that we can certainly invite them to do.
Well, we can sort of see how this evolves, but that's where I'm going with it personally, just because I think that all of us will have questions and...
And, you know, I'm just speculating here.
I agree.
Just speculating here, but I would suspect that if a wind farm were sited in Grand Forks, we may have the same type of, you know, issues too. So there are potentially two, you know, that's down the road and hypothetical, of course, but it may be. But first things first, we'll get additional information from the company. We'll get an answer, which they've indicated that they're working on getting as a partial implementation, and we'll see where that goes.
Okay.
So I went out of order, but I went out of order because on late filed Exhibit 49, which is the first one, there were changes to the turbine locations, and the reason for the changes were because of the consultation with the Air Force Base. But on late filed Exhibit 49, there's a supplement for the sound and shadow flicker monitoring that was requested at the hearing. I don't know if there's any specific questions on that, but essentially what these show are... There are all of the sound modeling indicates below 50 dBA for this project. The shadow flicker has been reduced as to one of the locations because of the removal of a turbine location at the request of the Air Force Base. I want to say that is turbine location 12. But in any event, long story short, the shadow flicker areas that are over 30 hours per year are in participating landowners' residences, and the company has indicated that they have waivers from all four of those receptors, those that are occupied by participating landowners. So that's 49.
And Zach, just... to make sure that I'm understanding it right, the four alternate locations were locations that were already listed as alternates when we had the hearing. So the locals that were there could see that those were possibilities.
That is correct.
So
yes, they were on.
Those aren't like a shocking new revelation that they're picking something new.
No, they were all on the maps and all of the materials. I'll get to it a little bit, but there are some additional studies that need to be done for some of the access roads that, you know, the company at the time didn't believe were going to have to be built, I'm suspecting. But we'll get to that. Okay. But aside from that, yes, they were all noticed. Everything was properly noticed as far as that. Receptor 28 is reduced to 30 hours or less because of the movement. And that's on late filed Exhibit 49, the summary. Okay, late filed Exhibit 50. There were some just general modifications to the transmission line structure locations. In lay filed Exhibit 50, you'll see a map, and the movements were, you know, as represented by the company at the hearing, relatively minor. But you can see those location changes from the exhibits, lay filed Exhibits 50. I don't really have any comment on that. I do have some information on the interconnection, but I think we can maybe hold that until we get to the end as far as where the company is at that. Late file Exhibit 51 is what we were talking about first, which is the exhibit explaining the coordination with the Air Force Department of Defense Clearinghouse after the hearing. We've talked about that already. Are there any other questions on those materials? We'll follow up with the company on that. Late file Exhibit 52. I don't have much to comment on, but it was requested the locations, the storage locations of the safe harbor turbines, and those are indicated on this late filed exhibit.
One thing on the communications with the Air Force, I'm sure you'll do this, but in conversations with the company, maybe staff can start getting some ideas of who would be the key contacts to pursue this with at the Air Force.
Okay. That's a good point. Okay. No questions on late filed Exhibit 52. Late filed Exhibit 50.
I think, Zach, the reason I asked that, though, and I found it useful, you know, many times we've heard talk of with various of these sighting cases that, we need to do this. There's all these jobs at Grand Forks with manufacturing these turbines. Well, clearly these are turbines that are coming from all over the country. They're setting in storage hundreds of miles away from North Dakota. So I just think that it's based on things that we've heard more anecdotally and in legislative discussions. I think it's an important piece of information to have in the file.
Sure. Late file Exhibit 53 is relating to the reduction of shadow flicker to 30 hours or less at receptor 41. So this was specifically talked about at the hearing. If alternate turbine, the company has indicated that this receptor would have less than 30 hours. If there's a turbine location there, they would use a particular model that would limit shadow flicker at receptor 41 to 30 hours or less. And that's explained in this late filed exhibit as to what they would do. We filed Exhibit 54, sound levels with existing wind farms, New Frontier Wind Farm and Prairie Wind 1, and the total sound levels. Those are all provided in this late filed exhibit. And that's provided in late filed Exhibit 49, so it's a little bit of a duplicate, but in late filed Exhibit 49, it does show the impact of the other two already existing wind farms and the noise sound modeling as to those. My review of it, and these gentlemen can correct me if my review is wrong, but it appeared to me that the two existing and the one proposed wind farms would have no cumulative impact on any receptor. There would be an impact because of one farm or the other. It would not be a cumulative impact.
So, quick question on that. So the study, it doesn't really, labeled in a way that suggests that this is cumulative.
If you look at,
or maybe I'm just missing that.
Yeah, and I don't disagree with you. It is.
Noise study results revised layout. Oh, There it is. Total sound. Duh. It is. It's a separate column. Never mind.
You had to dig for it a little bit. It's 49D.
Yeah.
If you look at that. But it appeared to me in reviewing it, it didn't appear that there was any overlap from any of the other particular projects, project or the existing farm. It appeared that each receptor's noise level was a result of single farm and not the others. And we talked a little bit about, like, for example, receptor 53 at the bottom of 49D, you know, 49.3 dB, well, that's all coming from New Frontier, and that was the company's point, and we had some discussion on that. And none of the sound or the noise is coming from the proposed Russo for that particular receptor. Late filed exhibit 55 is...
It's kind of mind-boggling that they can distinguish these things like that when there's other times when companies say, well, we can't really be sure that the sound is just coming from what we're adding. There's this kind of noise that's out there already, and some of it might be caused by that. So, I mean,
well,
I have an issue with this, but it does seem contrary to what we're often told about sound, is that you can't distinguish necessarily what exactly is coming from where.
Well, and I think, yeah, I mean, it is interesting, but these are models. You know, they didn't go out and, you know, with the microphone and test the actual sound.
Yeah.
But, I mean, they are modeling, and they are accepted. I mean, our expert has, our consultant, rather, David Hessler, has indicated that the studies done by the company and the modeling done by the company are appropriate. As you know, he's advocate for a lower decibel, but I mean, right now our regs are what they are, and in this particular case, this has been noticed and heard, and those are our regs. And regardless of what our consultant has opined on as far as 45 dBA being more appropriate, it's not something from the legal perspective that the commission can consider in this case.
And just so receptor 53 looks to me like it has the most sound.
Yes.
And can somebody remind me if that's a participating landowner? I'm looking at the chart to see. Receptor, I don't think the receptors are tied to this.
It may be on the other previously provided information, Commissioner. And I'm sure it's somewhere in here. I just don't have it. Oh, here it is, I think. Yeah, on late filed exhibit 49B. Oh, which one are you looking at, Jerry?
I don't see receptors.
Oh, never mind. That's...
Maybe we can just...
Yeah,
Jerry,
if you look at late file exhibit 49B, page 2, the occupied residence ID is on the far left column on 49B. If you go to page 2 and you go down to residence ID 53, it is a non-participating on this project.
Is that the same as... Receptor 53, though?
I believe so, because the sound is 49.3 listed as.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I suppose the receptors.
But again, we get into the issue of, well, it isn't the Russo project that is the cause or reason for the 49.3 dB. It's the, I think, New
Frontiers. That's the other one. I'm sorry. Okay.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does.
Okay. Thank you.
So I was just checking, because most of these are below the sound threshold recommended by the, in fact, all of them are by our expert. There isn't any listed for Russo that are higher than 45. 45.6 is the highest, I guess. So that's good.
Yeah. Okay. Late file exhibit 55 is SHPO's concurrence on the addendum to the Class 3 cultural resource inventory. Determined no significant archaeological sites affected, provided there are 6 specified sites to be avoided, and the companies agreed to avoid them. The exhibit also indicates that the SHPO has indicated that it accepts the unanticipated discovery plan of the company. Late file exhibit 56 is the architectural survey. This has was just recently completed and submitted to SHPO for its review. One of the items that the company would need to do is to provide the response from SHPO to the commission. They do indicate that initial feedback with SHPO, with Historical Society of North Dakota, indicates that they'll concur that there's a determination no adverse effects. Late file exhibit 57, country of origin for turbine components slash parts are listed. I didn't have any comments on that, but if there are any questions on that, or we need to discuss that further.
Does that conflict with the blades? They indicate Mexico and our United States, South Dakota and our North Dakota, but didn't the previous, an earlier exhibit we talked about, where the parts were warehoused, indicate that the blades are in Kansas?
I think this is the country of origin of the having manufactured, and the prior one was where they're stored. So after the manufacture, they're stored in the prior one. These are manufactured. And the countries of origin of components slash parts of the Siemens Gamesa turbines are anticipated as follows.
Okay. No, I missed that. Blades are currently in storage in Montrose. That's how you pronounce it, Iowa.
And those particular ones being stored are the safe harbor.
Mm-hmm.
These next two late file exhibits, 58 and 59, were not discussed at the hearing, but have since been, a motion has been made by the company to have them submitted as late filed exhibits. Just because they weren't discussed at the hearing, they weren't part of the record. There was some discussion, however, on late filed exhibit 58, to be fair, with an update on the Northern Long-Eared Bat mist netting survey. That survey was completed, and the result of it is no Northern Long-Eared Bats were detected in the area. And just a little bit more, just a procedural background, I asked the company to file a motion just so that we have everyone on the same playing field. You know, there is an intervener in this case. If the intervener were to have objected to having something not discussed at the hearing being presented, I felt it was appropriate for the commission to give the opportunity by requiring the company to make a motion to have documentation that wasn't discussed, noted at the late file as a late file exhibit at the hearing. There was no objection to anything on this, but I think from a procedural standpoint, it was appropriate to do, and that's why the company did a motion on 58 and 59.
Well, and wasn't there some follow-up required because there was an initial study that indicated that there may have been long-eared bats in this area, or they were hurt?
Yeah.
And they're a protected species.
That's all true, Commissioner. I think that it's a technicality that we lawyers like to adhere to, at least this lawyer does, in that it just wasn't something that was noted on the record. So to make it clear on the record that this was permitted as information, because I mean, I think we all agree here that, and the law requires that, look, we have a hearing, we notice the hearing, and that's your opportunity to present everything at the hearing.
Yeah.
And we can't have situations where new information is presented. It doesn't give parties the opportunity to examine, doesn't give us the opportunity to examine witnesses or ask questions about the exhibits. So that's why there's a process for documents that weren't provided at the hearing or discussed at the hearing to ask that they be received as part of the record after the hearing, and that's what was done here. But you're absolutely right, Commissioner, the Northern Longyear Bat was discussed. It just wasn't specifically discussed as to permitting a result of a survey, which seems a little bit perfunctory, but and I admit it is, but just to make sure that we're procedurally correct, that's what was done here.
Good. Well, we want to be procedurally correct, because usually things are overturned on procedure.
Yeah, that's I'll tell you what, that's having previously worked for the Attorney General's office and working for you folks, that is one of the areas that I'm looking at first. So then that brings us to the last late filed exhibit for the company. It's late filed exhibit 59. It's an update on an interconnection request. I actually have some updated information on this one, and you all are aware that at the hearing the company represented that it was in the MISO queue, was talking to MISO, had some issues with MISO and on the amounts, and it was after the hearing they received word from MISO that the cost of upgrade cost determination was greater than $500 million, and they had an issue with that. Now, what's stated in here is that Russo Wind has withdrawn its interconnection request from the MISO queue effective as August 9th, 2019, and exploring other interconnection options for the project, including potentially interconnecting at the same location via the Southwest Power Pool. I've since learned that there's just a little bit of a difference on explanation as to particularly what happened with that. As I understand it now in talking to Ms. Smith, the company was told that, look, to keep your place in the MISO queue, it needed to put in $30 million at that particular date. Because there was a disagreement that I would note the company and MISO are still discussing and still working on, that's something that Ms. Smith wanted to bring out and bring to your attention, that they are still working with MISO, that while they did not, as stated in the late filed Exhibit 59, Russo Wind has withdrawn, technically what happened was the company Russo was dropped by MISO from the queue because they did not pay the $30 million at that particular date. So it may be a distinction without a difference, but it is a distinction nonetheless that the company asked to bring out. So to be clear, though, Ms. Smith wanted me to indicate to you that there is, still efforts being made by the company to discuss with MISO as to the cost upgrade dispute. And I don't have the specific details as to what that is, but it's given the amounts, I'm sure you can imagine that it's, you know, fairly significant amount here.
So the price tag was $500 million, approximately.
Yes.
And
greater than $500 million.
Greater than $500 million. They did not pay the $30 million to stay
in the queue,
and
they were dropped.
So it really wasn't withdrawn, is the point you're making.
It
was removed.
Right. Right. It wasn't withdrawn.
Bottom line is they're not in the MISO queue anymore.
That's my understanding, but they are having discussions and they continue to reach out. No formal complaint yet, but they are looking at all options. The other thing is Ms. Smith updated me a little bit of additional information from what's been filed in the late filed exhibit, is that they've approached some third parties with interconnections that are pending on the MISO queue, and they are exploring that in addition to exploring Southwest Power Pool as well. So I think that the main takeaway, at least that I took from this late file exhibit, as well as conversations with the company's representatives, are the company is still very much working on resolving and solving the interconnection issue. They just haven't done it yet.
Well, this is it's a tricky thing for companies because now that they've dropped out, it changes that whole review and modeling. So anybody else still in would have a different answer to their study too, and others drop out. So if other people dropped out and these guys were in it, it might not be 500 million. It might be a lot less. So I really do appreciate the challenges that this creates for companies because it's expensive to stay in. MISO has to have it high like that because they have to know who's serious so that they can get the best results. So it's tough. It'll be interesting to see what happens with SPP.
So from where I sit, I don't have any, timeline or time frame as to when to expect any updates, but I'll represent to you all that I'm not going to forget about it, and we'll follow up with the company as far as what's going on, and I have no doubt that just from past working relationship that the company's attorney will also keep us up to date on what's going on as events unfold on this. I mean that it. I mean I don't. I mean this is me personally. I mean, and I think you probably all would agree with me. But I mean to leave a case, just sitting out there, which we have on the transmission line -29, and. I don't like it to sit out there. I'm sure you guys don't either. So we have to wait and see to some degree. But at the same time, I think the company understands too that that progress needs to be made on that as well.
Well, this is one of those areas where I know we've talked about in the past, but we've permitted other projects that don't have interconnections before, and we've always kind of viewed it as not being a key factor in our decision. And I still think that's appropriate. I do hope, though, that companies are being upfront with their participating landowners, because it's really confusing for those folks to be seeing like, oh, this permitting process is done, and we should be expecting this project any time. And it could be years of delay, if ever, with the way these queues are. So that's the only piece that I feel is potentially confusing by us permitting projects that don't have an interconnection.
Well, I mean, that's just, I was speaking specifically as to the transmission line project, because, I mean, that has been put on hold, right? I mean, we've postponed the hearing that we had to have because of issues with the notice. So I was speaking specifically as to that. I agree with you. I mean, we have permitted other cases, and I'm not suggesting that, that this be viewed negatively necessarily in the wind farm portion of the application -28, PU 1928.
I want to elaborate because I might view it a little bit differently, but we have done some where they didn't have their interconnection agreement done. I'm not sure we should have all the time. And there is one case that we approved that I voted against, and that was one of several reasons that accumulated and caused me to vote against that. And in that case, they went out and tore up a bunch of ground in a blizzard, and now we're over 2.5 years later, and everything's just setting there. I don't know what's going to happen with that. But I do have concerns with these, and the ones that we've done in the past, we did not knowing necessarily everything that we know now. And what we know now from working in SPP is that there's some rural areas that are being devastated by the costs of their transmission upgrades that are caused when generation facilities are built in their areas in order to get power to somewhere that wants that power. And they come in, especially if it's a ERIS application with very little review by SPP, They use open access opportunities to use the power lines that are there. And then when those power lines become congested, the upgrades end up costing the locals a whole bunch of money. And in this case particular, and there's another distinction between ones we've done in the past, besides that we didn't know as much about what happened in those cases as we do now. But in those cases, it was more clear in the hearing that it was an unknown. In this case, if you're one of those electric companies up in the area or the citizens who are paying their rates, you heard testimony that this company is building its own transmission line and it's going over and it's going to be into the MISO queue. And while it wasn't totally finalized, but that was the plan. Well, now this is a whole different plan if they're going to go into SPP potentially and have not laid out any real direction for exactly how they're going to do that. And I just think that the information that was provided in the hearing is very, very much different than what we're dealing with at this point. And I don't know that that was necessarily fair to people in that area.
So are you saying that you think that, I mean, are you leaning towards not supporting approving this without an interconnection agreement? Or are you still just thinking about it?
I'm kind of thinking about it. I guess I lean at this point toward, at the very least, there should be another hearing where people could provide feedback on what their potential consequences might be, and if they view it differently, if it's going into SPP, then what was discussed in Minot that day.
So am I understanding?
But really, I am getting, especially, and maybe things work completely differently in MISO, and it's not as much of an issue, but I am becoming, because of all the issues that we've dealt with in the RSE meetings, increasingly concerned about approving any new generation that's going into SPP until we know what that, until they have their interconnection agreement.
So I definitely appreciate some of the points you're raising and think they're valid. My question, or there's one question and a concern. So the question is, in SPP, I'm hearing you say that some of the interconnection costs or the upgrades are paid by the locals, where in a MISO, that's not the case. Those are the company's responsibility.
As not an electrical engineer, and maybe Victor's going to help me work through this, but through open access, I think the problem usually revolves around with an ERIS application, and they have their option between ERIS and NRIS, and I don't even remember what the letters stand for, but it's ERIS goes quickly, and there's not a very thorough evaluation of the impacts. And they get approved, and very generally they use open access laws and use existing transmission facilities. Then down the line, because now you've added a lot more energy into the system, if there are congestion issues, SPP comes in and recommends upgrades, and then those upgrades get applied a large part of the costs to the locals.
So just stopping there, just to, because I think that's a good comparison point, and that's what the study that MISO does identifies, and that's where the $500 million comes from. Some of those costs might have been to a line that was impacted in Wisconsin because of this project. I mean, they are very far-reaching impacts, and all of those costs are paid for by the company under MISO's.
Yeah. I will add, too, that in a not the most recent, but a recent RSC meeting, we've seen a SPP map with some of the hot spots of, you know, potential issues, and blazing away among like the two or three biggest hot spots was north central North Dakota. And we asked a lot of questions about it, and actually it had been, at least for the interim, partially a good part of it resolved by one of the companies adding some kind of post-contingent low-voltage system whereby they can quickly shed 22 megawatts of load. You know, that's frightening.
Yeah.
To think that, I mean, that's already happened. That has nothing to do with this, except for the fact that some of these local companies are on the edge already, and so we go up and have a hearing about this project, but it's going over there. You know, you don't have to deal with it over here. And so they don't testify, and we feel like we've been thorough, and I'm not sure it would have been.
So this is Victor Shook with staff. Just to kind of clarify a little bit on what Randy was setting up there. So NRIS, or NRIS, is network service, which is more akin to the MISO interconnection queue that you're more familiar with, where it does that full system test to ensure that it's deliverable anywhere in the footprint. So that's where those higher upgrade costs are going to come in, and they're kind of paying their share of that to get hooked up. The other option that you have in SPP is ERIS, or ERIS, which is energy-only resource. So I don't know the exact parameters, but essentially it doesn't kind of stress test the system at full load to ensure that you're going to be deliverable. You're just an energy-only resource who, kind of as there's space available, you can get on. So the upgrade costs are extremely minimal, but you're still going to be on the system pumping energy into it. What happened in Sunflower Electric's territory, which is in Kansas and Oklahoma, it's a very small co-op in the middle of a really hot wind area. They had a whole bunch of wind farms put up systems out there for delivery into the larger territories like Oklahoma City and Kansas City, places like that. And they got ERIS service. Well, Sunflower Electric is having all these upgrades necessary to its system since these wind farms were added in. I mean, they had, I forget what the numbers came out of, but it was two or three times what other utilities were seeing in the area for their costs. They have, 200%, I think, of the local load was in wind farms. So there was, you know, if they had their local load, I think was around 1,200 megawatts, something like that, and there was 3,000 or 4,000 megawatts of wind in their territory. So when those upgrades have to happen for reliability or for economic reasons, they have to pay for them because the load pays for those upgrades.
Is SPP looking at getting rid of ERIS?
It's being discussed, but they're trying some other ideas to fix that particular situation, whereby they would change the size of the zones within SPP.
So does anybody do the other NRIS? I mean, why would they?
If they need the capacity deliverable.
And then the last question on this, but how does SPP make sure that how do they keep track of the order? Like, these guys are on first, and so they get automatically, and these other ones only get on if there's capacity on the line.
Well, that's how the study is done to determine how much your interconnection costs are. When the system actually runs, from my understanding, that doesn't come into play, whether you have
ERIS. So this ERIS is kind of a false scenario.
So could you think of ERIS as being interruptible?
But it doesn't sound like they do it.
Yeah, non-firm.
Except for they all get access, and it's up to the locals to make it possible for them to do so. It doesn't sound like they're interrupting them if there isn't room.
As soon as there's the likelihood of interruptions, it's deemed as an area in need of upgrades, and they come in and do the upgrades and charge a bunch of it to the locals.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of them are coming from economic and reliability. You know, when they do reliability studies, you know, they'll say, okay, when this is all the way at max generation, and we lose a line. All of a sudden, there's a reliability issue that didn't show up before because we didn't have a 100 megawatt wind farm cranking away on a 115 line.
I want to stress though, Sunflower Electric is always kind of the face of this because they just got to a tipping point and got people going there at all these meetings and everything like that. But they weren't the only one that had this, and actually statistically, I don't think they were even the most adversely affected by the same
correct
situation.
Sunflower is just the most vocal. The issue they're trying to even figure out how large the issue is, if it extends to other mm-hmm. regions. North Dakota was even identified as a potential high wind area that could potentially see such an issue.
So then as it relates to this project, it seems like it would be relevant for the company to clarify whether they're seeking service with SPP under ERIS or NRIS. If it's NRIS, then I think your issues would probably be less.
It would be less. I probably would need to do more research to find out if they would become non-existent on mm-hmm. that point.
Well, then to the kind of final point on this issue, I'm interested from the legal standpoint, and Zach, you can look into it more if you want, but this would definitely be a change for the commission to use the lack of an interconnection agreement as a criteria for not approving or saying we can't approve it yet or whatever. So I'm interested in some analysis on the grounds for that.
I can look into that, Commissioner.
That would be awesome. Thank you.
I think, though, I want to highlight a detail of that, though. Yes, that's one part of the picture. Is there an interconnection agreement or is there not an interconnection agreement? But to me, the other part of the picture is, did you indicate it's going to one RTO in the hearing and in the lead up to the hearing so that the participants in the other RTO didn't feel they had need to be concerned?
Mm-hmm. So that's more a question of another hearing? Is that what you're suggesting?
Or some option for them to speak up? Or I don't know how you technically do it, but I guess, and I'm just going to meld things together here. I think we have two big issues here with this where I don't feel like I came away from that hearing thinking that this was a very likely project to that I would support. But now I feel like, A, we led everyone, people were led to believe that there was a certain plan for interconnection, and that plan involved MISO. Now there isn't really a plan, but when one is developed, it will probably be SPP. That's one thing. Secondly, and this isn't a quote from the tape, but it's my note, so I'm thinking that that's what other people kind of heard, that the company planned to install the ADLS system but can't get the FAA approval until turbine selection is finalized. They hope to have that done soon. Mm-hmm. Now, probably there may not be an ADLS system, and would the locals have felt differently about it if they knew that lights were probably going to be on all night long as opposed to what our law and what the hearing information was? Mm-hmm. I just think that the hearing didn't really provide a picture of what's going to happen here anymore.
There's certainly changed circumstances in this case, more so than in most other cases.
Okay. Good points, Randy.
We already have to have another hearing in the interconnection agreement, or rather in the transmission line case. Maybe we let we let this stew a little bit, let staff work on addressing some of these questions slash issues. I don't know, maybe I'm speaking a little bit out of line, but maybe a second work session on this case is probably going to be needed, I think.
I think we will, because there's, you know, more information we're getting from the Air Force and more information to come on the interconnection. And and then we have this final issue to talk about, too.
Yep.
So.
There is one other thing. we got from Kevin Prentice, the intervenors, Liuna, filed yesterday a response to applicants' proposed findings of facts, conclusions of law and order, and that included a what I call a legal memo from a North Dakota attorney opining on the impacts of local labor being used in the analysis by the commission. Be honest with you, I didn't have a chance to review this in great detail. I did skim it. I will say this. My understanding was is that a proposed findings was going to be submitted, and this is a response. I did get a call from the company's attorney indicating that it's very likely that the company would want to be responding to this. So I just don't think it's appropriate, just given that we just got this yesterday, especially now that we know we're going to have a second work session. Let's let staff digest it, see how the company wants to address it. My suspicion is that the company will probably address some of what's been said in here, and I think it's appropriate from a procedural standpoint that they be given the opportunity for nothing else. It wasn't really indicated at the hearing that, you know, any additional documents or any opinion was going to be provided by the intervener. This letter is dated from the attorney August 16th, so it's a new document, you know, opining about positions that the commission has taken in other cases and opining as to what can be done in an order, for example, if the commission at the request, you'll recall at the hearing, the laborers requested that monitoring data be provided as far as where the local workforce, where the workforce rather, in constructing the proposed project, where they're from, and some other details that apparently is being done in Minnesota. They've requested that in the past. In prior wind farm proceeding, the commission did not go ahead with that, but laborers have asked for that to be reevaluated in this case.
So just to clarify, you believe the company response will be something along the lines of an outline in terms of where they will pull labor from to complete the project?
No, I don't think that the response would be that. I think that the response would be, I'd really be speculating as to what the company's response would be. And, you know, given this is just filed yesterday, I mean, I don't even have a full grasp on what my opinion is on it yet, to be honest with you.
So you just expect a response from
I would expect a response.
You haven't.
I don't know what the response will be.
You had a call from the company saying they
want
to respond, right?
Effectively, yes. Yeah. And I think that they wanted to see what would potentially be discussed at the work session on this. I mean, I will say this. I mean, I need to talk to Jack. I see this document being filed as more of kind of a late filed exhibit, especially the legal memo. And I think just as we require the company to do a motion to do the late filed exhibit from the procedural standpoint, I'm leaning toward right now, you know, sending an email to Mr. Prentice just indicating, hey, can you do a motion? And then when he does the motion, then that gives the company the opportunity to respond, lay out what its position is if anything, and it could be the company doesn't respond, and then we have nothing from the company. But just from a procedural standpoint, just so it's, again, a level playing field for both parties, because we have an intervener in this case and the company, that everyone be given the same opportunities to respond. And then we can look at it, we can analyze it, we can discuss it. I think that's just probably the procedural proper way to do it.
I think that makes sense. And we probably shouldn't get into too much of the discussion today then.
I'm not prepared to have a detailed discussion on it.
Yeah. From a procedural standpoint, does Mr. Broughton represent them? Is there any requirement that the attorney be officially representing them? Or I was a little confused by that because he wasn't at the hearing and wasn't the one that petitioned to intervene, et cetera.
Yeah, that's a good question. No, Mr. Broughton is not their attorney in the proceeding. He hasn't been noticed as their attorney. It appears, though, that, you know, the laborers hired him specifically to research the issue and to give his opinion to them, which then they've taken and submitted in this proceeding.
Yeah.
So Mr. Broughton
that truly is new information.
It is.
Really, that is separate from the discussion at the hearing. I mean,
right.
it's on the same topic, but it's a new take on it.
I mean, for example, the ALJ after the hearing sent out a letter outlining specifically all of the late filed exhibits, when the findings of facts would be provided by a certain date. So, I mean, that was all agreed to at the hearing. Mr. Prantis was there. You know, there were two exhibits that the company submitted that were late. I mean, we're talking about issues that, you know, weren't discussed at the hearing related to the interconnection with the company. I think just from a procedural standpoint, we just need to ask Mr. Prantis and the laborers to, you know, make a formal request. I can tell them what to do. Once we get that, then that just gives the company the opportunity to file a response if they want to. And then we'll have where everyone stands, and we can take a look at it then.
Well, I think it would only be reasonable for the company, and they're listening, obviously. They have representatives here and listening in, that they provide as much detail as they can on who will actually be doing the work.
I just want to add one thing on that, too. You know, on various siting cases, oftentimes someone has an issue with a project and companies do things and, you know, it becomes a part of our record that we wouldn't be able to make them do, but they do it in order to make a complaint go away and keep things moving forward. They do things voluntarily. That's a frequent occurrence.
Mm-hmm.
A big part of this, as I read it, is a request, you know, because I can imagine it's hard for the company to foresee or get into a situation where, oh, this next position has to be held open for a person from a certain geographical area because we're on the bubble of some kind of a quota that we agreed to. But to the extent that there's a request for quarterly or maybe some other time period reports, and then I'm reading from this, so that ultimately data might inform future decisions by the commission and other state leaders, maybe that's something the company just agrees to. We can report and you can gather information from this. So here's my future question for you after you've had more time to digest this.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the company just comes back and says, yeah, we'll do reports and let's learn from this one. If they don't, if they resist that, at some point my question for you, Zach, will be, would that be, if we chose to require those reports, would that be going beyond our legal authority in a citing case, or does that fall into our authority as, I mean, it was kind of suggested that it does in this memo from them, but
yeah.
I'd be curious your opinion. But maybe it's not needed. We'll see if the company just wants
to. Yeah, no, I understand your question, and that's something that I'll work on in advance, and we'll see. maybe we won't have to answer definitively in this case, but you know, it very well could be that in the next case that we may have to. So I think it's worthwhile to take a look at that.
Well, I have a lot of thoughts on this, but I'll withhold judgment until we hear the response from the company.
Commissioners, I don't have anything else on my agenda other than, I'm sorry, I do. Then I'll be done, unless you guys have more questions. But on the proposed findings of facts, conclusions of law, and this is probably more teed up for the next work session, but if you look at specifically paragraph 27 of the findings of fact, it's on page 8, that's where the company discusses the discussions with the Air Force and the removal of the turbines, replacement of the turbines and substitution of the alternates. I would note that, and I did mention earlier, but in paragraphs 14 and 15, the company indicates that it would have to do wetland delineations of the access roads, collection lines, and crane paths for the activated alternates, the T-48, 51, 53, and 54. They indicate in the proposed findings that they would do it prior to construction. They would also need to do, in paragraph 18, they indicate that they would need to do Class 3 cultural resource survey of all previously unsurveyed areas. With the exception, they've done that with the exception of the access roads, collection lines, and crane paths for newly activated turbines. So they would have to do that, and they're proposing that they be permitted, but they be allowed to do that, you know, prior to construction. So I just wanted to point those two areas out because that would require further survey work by the company and submission of documents. But that's just another thing I think to add to the list, probably to follow up with at the next work session.
You know, I guess since Randy made some comments suggesting the company might do something voluntarily on the issue regarding labor, I do want to weigh in just a bit because I might be seeing this differently than my colleagues. And I think this is an area that is where the commission is dangerously stepping outside of its bounds, or could be. How the companies, yes, we want to encourage companies to hire local and look at the economic impact, but suggesting that we should be dictating those kinds of decisions by the company, to me, is not our job. So I just want to make that clear on the outset here, that I think it's a criteria we can look at and discuss, and we always do at the hearings. But those kinds of hiring decisions are decisions that I feel need to be retained by the companies themselves and not directed by regulators.
I would note, too, that you know, there is prior precedent on this from the commission. I was not involved in that analysis, but there is prior precedent on this specific request, and that'll have to be analyzed, and that's something that I will be looking into in greater detail. We'll be able to be prepared to comment on further at the next work session.
So we've covered everything, Zach?
Everything that I have, I think, yeah. If, unless any of you commissioners have anything further, or Jerry or Adam have anything else that we should talk about today.
Okay.
Any other comments?
No.
Commissioner Chris?
No.
All right, then this work session is adjourned. Thank you.